Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Here we go. It's the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Welcome, friends, to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. We are in the middle of a series that we're doing on spiritual formation. If you haven't listened to the first couple episodes, I would encourage you to go back and listen to them. They're great, with Jem and Alan Fadling, spiritual directors, and with Father Albert Haas, a Franciscan, on becoming an ordinary mystic. And then Jem and Alan talk great about meeting God in your actual life. But today we want to talk with Jim Wilder. I did this interview with Jim a while back on Jim is a wild guy. I mean, I don't mean to make a pun about his name, but his combination of spiritual formation. He also has all this like what does he call himself? A neurotheologian. I think he says this in the interview. A neurotheologian. This kind of combination of theology and neurology, and all this stuff that he brings together in a really unique package. I really enjoyed this interview, and he's got some connections with Dallas Willard, who's a huge influence for all of us. All of that kind of thing. So, anyway, this interview was fascinating.
That's a big deal. When you found that out, Ben, did you say, "Did we just become best friends?"
Did we just become? Yeah, that's basically. I told him that. He didn't respond, so I don't think he saw that movie.
Strinky has this thing where he like quotes Dallas Willard off the cuff just as a way of like low-key impressing people. And
he actually, though, he writes Willard quotes on his arm. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. If you look at his sleeve, it's all full of Willard quotes.
Yeah. Well, that's why he's got no sleeves today. And he's...
I've got extra room for Willard quotes. I'm going to mow the lawn this morning. So, anyway.
But Jim actually, Wilder actually had a good friendship with Dallas Willard, and he relates in this interview how he like approaches Willard with like, "Hey, here's a hole in your typology. Here's something you're missing." And Willard is like, "You're right." And Wilder's like, "I'll take care of that." Basically, so Wilder sets out to sort of connect what Dallas was doing theologically and spiritually to what we know about neurology and brain science.
Yeah. So
this interview is pretty fascinating because awesome. Wilder sort of connects Dallas to science.
Because he was saying, if I remember this correctly, he was saying that Dallas was often frustrated that like people couldn't grasp the vision for why you'd want to become a disciple. You know, like Willard's, a lot of his stuff is like, here's what it means to be a disciple. But that first part, that vision of like, why would I want to become a disciple was a big deal for Dallas. But I think that's where Jim came in. And he said, you would want to become a disciple of Jesus if you were lovingly attached, like emotionally lovingly attached to God. If that was taking place. And he sort of brings a lot of the science about that we know about attachment into this realm of, you know, that's mostly been taken care of by theologians. And it's just a fascinating concept. I found myself just really thinking about, even in my own life, as I listened to Jim talk, I was thinking about in my own life, I'm like, does that characterize me? Like, am I lovingly attached to God or, you know, like, I just realized, like, I don't think about my relationship with God like that. I think about it differently. And I started to wonder, like, I wonder if it would be fruitful and helpful for me to think about attachment theory, you know, as I think about God. Maybe if that would draw me, I don't know, a little bit more strongly into the things that I most deeply want.
So, all right.
This is a great
interview. Series. This is an important series, guys.
I think so too. One of the things that maybe I just was reflecting on this. One of the reasons maybe we haven't done this is because we've just been trying to do it. In particular with Wilder, we have benefited so much from Dallas Willard and the way Wilder employs some scientific discoveries that this is like a conversation with some of our influences. Like if you look up our family tree, this is where we, this is from which we were begotten. So
no, it is. That's a good way of putting it. I think it's a really good way of putting it. And I think that's also, it's also interesting that you tend not to do a series about the thing that you're just doing all the time because you don't realize it is a thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
I remember the first time, like I, you know, this is the influence of Willard on my life is he's so, the Divine Conspiracy so radically reshaped what I thought ministry was, like around these ideas of formation. Like it's so radically reshaped. It was like, oh, ministry is about formation. That it, I remember like a few years later, it surprised me when someone said like one of the focuses, they're like, yeah, one of the things I focus on is formation as a pastor. And I remember it feeling surprising to me. I'm like, one of the things? Like, what else is there to, and I know there's other things to focus on. But anyway, I guess that perspective is helpful just to realize like when you get so deeply into something, you don't realize that it still needs to be talked about because, you know, it's not just, it's not just water that everybody swims in. Right. Yeah.
Like it's, we're doing spiritual formation, but we've got this awesome children's choir also.
right. I suppose. Yeah. So anyway, enjoy this interview. We're having fun in this series. We're going to do a couple more. Next week, we're going to talk with somebody named KJ Ramsey about finding grace when suffering, like how does formation happen through suffering when you don't choose it? A lot of our formation stuff has also been, has been about stuff we can choose. You know, it's a discipline we can adopt or something we can, but suffering is obviously something that none of us ever chooses unless we're psychotic. And so we want to talk about that and then share a story with somebody who went through a season of suffering as well. So both of those will be next week. But for now, enjoy this interview with Jim Wilder. Jim Wilder, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
It's good to be here with you, Ben.
Yeah.
And Matt also.
Yes, Matt. Matt's here as well. So, Jim, before we dive in, maybe just give our listeners a little bit of an introduction to you. What do you do? What do you spend your time doing? Who are you? Where do you live? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, I'm generally known as the neurotheologian behind the LAIF model. Okay. And what that means is that I have a background in psychology and neurology and how the brain works. And very fascinated by how did Jesus teach his human brain to do what God wanted. And at some point along the line, it occurred to me that the whole objective of living the Christian life was learning how God had intended us to be. And so I've been over the years chasing that around with a whole big group of people, all of whom have said, you know, we're just not getting the transformation we want to get. Been the center of this group and trying to create a model around what does really transform.
Yes. Yeah, that resonates. I mean, Jim, that resonates a lot with me. I think it resonates a lot with our audience, with Gravity Leadership, our community. Yeah. As well, my a lot of what you're talking about is the stuff that we're passionate about, and so we talk a lot about spiritual formation and leadership. And we train people to kind of lead from love. We you know, and we bring insights, that neurology part of it is really fascinating to us, psychological insights, how all those things interlock and overlap. And Dallas Willard has been hugely influential for us in that as well. Reading The Divine Conspiracy was kind of my gateway drug into just everything that's important to me now. You know what I mean? Like the way I see the world, the way I see the kingdom, all of that kind of stuff. So he was hugely influential. And you've written a new book called Renovated, God, Dallas Willard, and the Church That Transforms is the subtitle. So you're talking all of our languages here. This is really great.
This is Ben's love language, Jim.
Yeah, this is awesome. Yeah, yeah. I love all those things. I love God. I love Dallas Willard. Anyway, I love transformation. Anyway, but that angst, if you will, also drew me in. Like, I'm not being like, is this all there is to it? You know, like, I'd love to chat with you a little bit about this book. Maybe we can start, Jim, with the story of kind of how this book came about. You had a relationship with Dallas and his wife, Jane. And he had kind of said some things a couple weeks before he died that were the genesis of this book, at least the ideas that are here.
Yeah, it's as Dallas has a way of doing, he suddenly sends you off in a different direction with on a perspective that you weren't expecting to have. You know,
it's
oh, I'd never seen that before.
Hmm.
But actually, to chase it back a little bit earlier, back in the 70s, I started working in a community counseling center that was started by one of the mega churches in California to reach street kids. And they found out that a lot of the street kids had actually been in church as kids, but they disillusioned with the amount of transformation that the older generation had. It's like, if that's the best you can do, we're going to look for a better life. And so they, you know, the better life wasn't so better, but all the same. So my supervisor, one of my first supervisors, was Jane Willard. And at that point, you know, she's just a very experienced, very good counselor, and became director of training of our little center. Said one day she was going to bring her husband in, Dallas Willard, who was a history professor, and I mean, sorry, a philosophy professor. Yes. Yeah, yeah. So this is going to be dry. And the first thing he did when he walked in was started messing with my head, all of our heads. And he said, you know, psychology is the care of souls. And the most important thing about caring for souls is you have to love them. And all of my professional training was, you never love anybody. You don't get involved with any. You don't get connected with anybody. You stay professionally as distant as possible.
Yeah, right.
And I realized pastors were being trained the same way, because I'd gone got my degree from seminary. Yeah. So we're all going to be distant and professional. And then Jesus says that didn't work. You don't.
Yeah. And so does Dallas. Yeah.
So does Dallas, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right then I knew my career was ruined.
Yeah. I mean, Dallas did have a way of saying things that, you know, like you said, this is going to be dry, but he wasn't exactly flashy, but he had such wisdom and weight behind his words that he could say something as simple as, well, you know, the most important thing about caring for souls is that you love them. And then you know, it ruins your career and sets you on a completely new trajectory. So,
right. So then we start digging into what does it mean to love people and to become, you know, more like Jesus. And Jane did the second thing that kind of changed my direction. And she said, you know, I know you're a psychologist and all, but down in my office, we're inviting Jesus to come and be a part of things. And we're getting to this tremendous change in people. And actually, that's what I went into psychology to try to figure out. I wanted to say, well, how does it work that Jesus' presence is an active force that changes things?
Wow.
And even getting my degree in psychology from a seminary, they didn't answer that question. How does it, you know, how does this can work? How do you do it? How do you get Jesus there? What, you know, what does he do when he's there? And how it's, I got to do with healing and change. So now that I know that Jesus is an active presence, and if he shows up, things are going to change, and you have to love people. Then we started looking at the people that came in, all of them getting the same kind of help. You know, let's say 3/4 of them getting better, but 1/4 aren't. And then meanwhile, Dallas is working at his end with spiritual formation, spiritual disciplines and stuff like that. And again, they're getting results for, you know, a lot of people, a lot of times, but some people it doesn't seem to work for. And other people stall out, you know, I mean, it starts out with a lot of transformation and then you're doing a lot of solitude and, suddenly, you know, the yield just starts to drop.
Yeah.
And so we're both noticing, you know, we're working on this from different sides. But at that point, we asked a real interesting question of our community, really, because there's about 30 people involved. You know, I'm the guy that gets to talk about it. And some people try to credit me with it. But it's, you know, I was part of this group is what I, you know, have to say. So we're saying, you know, why are we getting results some places and not others? Let's sort of compare notes, because it looked at like the people doing really well with Dallas did really terrible in the counseling office. And, you know, like they couldn't get a yield out of the spiritual disciplines. It was just sort of like asceticism, just, you know. Our lives have already not had enough. Now we're taking away more stuff, you know, and looking at everyone who's trying to work one of these sides of things, the spiritual side, the healing side, the, you know, the psychology side, the neuroscience side. Okay. And the objective for all of them was to become a mature person. But okay, the language and the techniques being used on each of those fields varied a huge amount from other people trying to get the same spiritual maturity. And Dallas had this interesting way of measuring it. He said, essentially, you're spiritually mature when you spontaneously love your enemies. And, you know, that
spontaneously meaning like I don't have to, it's not premeditated, but like what comes out of me unbidden when I have an enemy is love.
Exactly that. Yes. Okay. He was very much against sin management.
Yep.
Where, you know, you have this internal response and you go, oh crap, that's not spiritual. And right, now I've got to, I got to change it. But my internal response, yeah, is so, not love.
Yeah. So paying attention to the internal response was important for Dallas in terms of your spiritual maturity isn't measured in how well did I control my, you know, desire to punch that guy in the face. It's no, I know I'm becoming mature when I don't actually want to punch anybody anymore.
Exactly that.
Like when I actually, what comes out of me when somebody attacks me is love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Then, and so if that's the measure and all of us are trying to do, get to that same spot using different techniques, why isn't it working for some people? That was our question. And we basically spent 40 years trying to unravel that with some solutions.
Yes.
And so here's an interesting thing. The spontaneous part of us runs in the right side of the brain in what we would call the fast track. It runs faster than conscious thought.
Okay.
And what goes into that track to form it comes out of it, basically our attachments. Who are we attached to in a significant way? And that raised a very interesting question for Dallas and for us. Is spiritual maturity the same as emotional maturity? Because to go in that track, that's your emotional maturity track. Shouldn't spiritual maturity include everything that emotional maturity has? So you at least be as good as every other human being.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And then you add something to it that would only come from the character of Christ. So Spiritual maturity is all of normal maturity plus something that happens with the active presence of Jesus and of his people.
Yeah.
And that's what brought us to do a conference together.
Okay.
And as we're
it's the Heart and Soul Conference.
Yeah, Heart and Soul Conference in 2012.
Okay.
And we just felt it was, this is a very crucial time to start this conversation. So we invited everyone that we could. And during that conference is when we actually discovered that Dallas had a terminal condition.
Really?
And it was, I was in the back room, the green room, you might say, with Dallas and Jane, and we were talking about these things, and they're running tests and trying to find out what was going on. So, so he's really pouring himself into this conference. And at that point I said, you know, the only way your brain will actually let you have these spontaneous reactions that change your character is if it comes out of attachment to others. Now suppose that what the Bible talks about is love is actually an enduring eternal attachment between God and his people that he intends for us to experience not only with him but with each other.
Wow.
It's not just an emotion. It's not a we're going to not just choosing to do good things for other people, but actually we care about them so much that we'll weep with them if they were weeping. We'll laugh with them if they're laughing. We'll, whatever their experience is, won't separate us from this connection we have with each other. That's the only way you can get into this fast track of the brain that changes our character. He said, well, you know, I've never seen or heard before of a soteriology of attachment. Now, this is the first time this thought crossed my mind. So we were sitting there now. He said, I don't have time to work on this. We were going to do a project, a year-long project. He says, I'm not going to live to do that. And I've never heard of soteriology, that's salvation.
Right.
Based on the new attachment with God. But obviously to change character in a human brain, you have to have this attachment, or we just have the right ideas, but we don't have the right responses.
Yes.
And so he left me sort of to complete this dialogue, you know, why don't you look into that, see if that's what the Bible means. And so this is the reason for the book, Renovated. Mm-hmm. It's sort of, it's the same publisher as he used for Renovation of the Heart.
Okay.
And Renovated is sort of the next step.
Yes.
Suppose that now what we really need to do is form attachments with God, active attachments with God who's present and doing something, not just an idea or a good belief.
Jim, could you, maybe for those of our listeners who are unfamiliar with attachment theory and the brain science behind that, could you describe some of the distinguishing differences between a belief about God and attachment to God?
Yeah, that's a very, very important thing. I actually have in the book, quite conveniently, a list of 12 characteristics of a real attachment. Sorry, my voice just gave out.
Yeah, take a drink. Do what you need to do.
Yeah, I think I got it back. Dry weather up here in the mountains. Okay, so 12 characteristics for the brain of an attachment. The first is that it really connects us to the source of life. In other words, whatever this relationship is, has to be the source of life for us. So we attach often through food, the one who feeds us, the one who gives us our drink, the one who says, of every fruit in the garden you may eat. And oddly enough, the first sin was letting someone else feed us. But now if salvation is saying that God would be our food, he'd be our bread, he'd be the bread of life, he'd be our drink, you know, where do we see this in Scripture? Is God interested in that? Did Jesus decide the first thing he's going to do with people is he will feed them? Mm. He's a source of life. Attachment is this thing. We look at you and go like, feed me, you know. You know, we don't go to Baal to say, give me some food. You know, we go to the one who feeds us, the one who gives us life. Second characteristic is that it's a unique attachment. The brain does not allow substitutes. So when somebody becomes my mother or my father, I can meet a lot of other nice people, but the brain just doesn't let one substitute for the other. And if you ever had a child whose hamster died, you realize you just can't swap out another hamster because it's unique attachment. It's this isn't, you know, fuzzy.
So this the unique person is important. It can't just be any old father, any old mother, any old God. Right. Okay.
Yeah. So it's unique. It's a source of life. And a third characteristic is that it's seen as special. So whatever it is, you're not just connected to it.
Yeah.
You know, but wow, it this connection delights in you, this person, this one looks at you and go, I love you. I'm so into you. You know, just you make my eyes light up and that kind of thing. We build joy back and forth. It provides both joy and rest. If you don't let someone rest, you can't form a good attachment. Develops a mutual mind. You start to think like the other person. You know what they're going to say. You know what they're thinking when something happens. It grows stronger by moving closer and farther apart. So it isn't a matter of just always being together, but when they're not there, they're still in your heart. You're still acting as though they're a presence in your life. It shares both positive and negative emotions. So it's not just for good times. It's also for we're together, you know, when it hurts. And it helps all parties to be stable and act like themselves, provides freedom and connection, stretches our limits so that we grow, and it creates an enduring people. Now the question is, do we see that in Scripture anywhere?
Yeah. I don't think so. No, just kidding. That's it. It's everywhere, right? This is how God talks to his people.
It seems like that, So the first thing I noticed about the churches and about counseling and about most of the spiritual programs was that we were not creating an enduring people. We were creating an experience. We were creating something, you know, a touch point. And so this transforming life with God became sort of like mountaintop experiences. You get them from time to time. But it wasn't a way that we live with one another. And so this, if salvation is about a new attachment, interesting thing about the brain is it needs to have God in it or it'll never become more than just what human beings do. But on the other hand, for the brain, it has to be practiced with another person or it doesn't become character. So we would need for this to work that God would say, you have to have a love attachment with me that's joyful. And you got to practice that with everybody else. Does that sound familiar?
It does.
Yes, yes, Jim. Where have you been? I'm 44. I needed this 43 years ago. This is brilliant.
Didn't we all? Yeah.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
So let me ask you kind of a nerdy question. When you say attachment, how is that different from attunement? Is attunement included in attachment? Or how do you define those?
That's a very good question. Attachment leads to good attunement, but they're quite different. The attachment is what makes all the little ducks follow their mother. Attachment is what makes people run into a burning building with no chance of saving their child, but their child is in there and they're going to try it anyway. These are the things that are run by attachment. But if we live in attachment with someone else, the attunement part is we start to think with them. We start to, we would call that mutual mind. We start to having the same outlook on things. So let's go back to our test that Dallas gave us, a spontaneous love for your enemies. If you're living with God and you realize that almost everybody on earth starts out with kind of a, I'm in an enemy position with God, right? We're not on his side. We're on our side. And God looks at them and goes, wow, you need a connection with me that's going to teach you who you really are. If I'm looking and seeing how God does that time after time after time, what ends up happening quite spontaneously in my mind is someone starts acting like an enemy. And I say, well, whoa, you really need to experience some of God's love and his perspective, because right now you have no idea who he has created you to be. And it hurts. But, you know, boy, do you need what I have right now to change, you know, who you think you are. That spontaneous reaction is attunement. It's thinking now about other people as instead of enemies are people I attack, enemies are people who really need to see God's perspective on the world. And you only do that by thinking with God through experiences and growing together. So that's attunement, but we won't develop it if we're not attached to God. We'll just say those crazy people over there think this way.
Or maybe I should.
Yeah.
I know it in my head, but it's not in my heart. We have a lot of ways of talking about this conundrum, don't we?
True, yes.
So attunement is more an activity. It's something that happens when we're attached, which it feels to me like the attachment is more of a state of being. It's a way of being. I don't know. Is that how you describe it? Is there a better way to do it?
Well, because it's the most powerful of human motives, it's been described lots of ways. But we notice it mostly when it's missing. We say, I'm lonely. We say, you know, someone has died. We think we lost. We mourn that. It's this desire to be with somebody, you know, that, you know, no one else will substitute. And they're the only one for me and the one I want right now. It's, you know, why we feel badly for orphans and strangers. You know, they have nobody that feels that way for them. So it's, you know, you could say it's a way of being, but it's so relational.
Attachment
must connect to somebody else who means something to me. And it's a little bit like marrying God.
Right.
It's almost like we're his bride, you know, and all of a sudden he's got this family that he loves and cares for. And because we're marrying into that family, we have to get to know and love and care for these people we would not otherwise give a hoot about.
So that part of it is, I think, especially interesting for me, because I think it's especially interesting to our audience. A lot of church leaders, a lot of pastors. And I think one of the things that I hear your kind of vision of salvation as a new attachment to God. One of the things that's fascinating about that is your 12th aspect of it, which is that it creates an enduring people. I think oftentimes the spiritual discipline movement or the spiritual formation movement, it can, probably unfairly, but it can sort of get talked about as if it were just about individuals, as you said, having these mountaintop experiences. So it's an individual who goes on a lot of retreats. That's a spiritual formed person, right? But I'm especially interested then for you to talk about how this salvation as attachment and the disciplines and the actions that flow from that, how it forms a people. And what you would say, so if I'm a pastor and I'm listening to this and I'm resonating, right? I'm like, oh, I need this for myself, but I also want my church to become a church that transforms, a church that is part of this enduring people. How do I how do I begin to make this turn? I don't know if there's like a million questions in that, Jim, but maybe you can sort something out from that.
Yeah. You definitely grabbed the tiger by the tail there. you know, that's the live issue we've got in front of us. And so here's the problem that we have. What we can do consciously in the slow track of our brain doesn't really change our character very much. It changes our plans and directions. And almost all the spiritual formation stuff is corrective. Michael Sullivan, who I work with, calls them humility drills. They're things that remove from our life the things that get in God's way.
Okay.
And so we clear space for them. One of the things that Dallas points out is that none of the spiritual disciplines have spiritual value in and of themselves.
That's right.
There's something that we do to make room for God.
Yes.
And we can do that intentionally. We can work on that. And so from every life that wants to become like God, some things must be removed. There's things in our life that just wasn't the way God wanted us to be.
Yeah.
And the spiritual disciplines are really designed to help move those out of the way.
Okay.
But the other side of spiritual formation is the growth of a new self, one that looks a whole lot more like Jesus than who we thought we would ever be.
Yes.
It's someone we couldn't imagine ourselves to be. And that requires attachment and connection with other people. And where you see it happening is precisely in those places where Christians are in the mix with people they don't want to be with.
Enemies, if you will.
Enemies, if you will, yes. And most of the enemies are people we know. Right. So, you know, when you're having a fight with your wife, she feels like your enemy.
Right.
Now, right then, are you able to bring the presence of Jesus in or not? That depends on what will happen to your character. Yeah. But in the average church, you know, the smiles go on when you hit the parking lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so you bring that to church.
Yeah. Yes. And we're avoiding talking about it. We're avoiding having the conversation that would bring up the conflict. But the irony is that's the very place we need to practice.
Yes.
If we're going to grow this new self. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
For a long time, I just left that benchmark that Dallas had as this is how we measure it. But I found very few people getting any closer. They always said, there's the one that'll make me fail the spiritual test, you know. But when I find places in the church where the people around them don't like Christians, it's precisely in those places you find the most change to Christlikeness. It's precisely when people go into the neighborhood of people they don't like and form a community there that says, we're going to form an eternal community. You may start out not liking me, but that's exactly why I need to be here. I need to learn how to be Christ when, you know, under these conditions. That's what'll change my heart. When you put the weak and the strong together, so most churches, the recovery group is in the basement, and you let them come, but they never join the main, you know.
Yeah, and Thursday night, you know.
Yeah, Thursday night, right. Mm-hmm. And we let them put their posters out there, but, you know, the weak and the strong never intermingle. Mm-hmm. And when you do, everybody feels out of their comfort zone.
Yeah.
I'm with people I don't like being with, but Jesus doesn't see it that way.
Yeah.
So how do I see this moment in the way that Jesus sees it? To me, the essential question then becomes, do we practice when we're together, especially when we're upset, stopping and seeing this moment the way Jesus sees it?
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, we have to be enough connected with him to say, I don't feel like doing this, but for your sake.
Yeah. Yeah. We have to trust him enough to enter into the badness of whatever's happening. We have to trust Jesus enough to know there's goodness beyond the badness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Otherwise we won't enter in. We'll just be so conscious of the badness of the situation that we won't, why would I do this? Let's set up these insulating barriers. Let's keep the weak and the strong separate. Mm-hmm. Let's figure out how not to have conflict. Let's never enter into uncomfortable situations because all I'm conscious of is the badness. I'm not sufficiently attached to Jesus to trust him to say, hey, like you need this situation. Like you need to attend to this.
Yeah, we had an interesting experiment with something we call the Emmanuel process. And that is we teach people simply to quiet themselves, think of something that makes them grateful to God. Mm-hmm. And as they're feeling grateful to God, they begin to experience his presence live. It just happens, you know. There's an interesting thing. Anytime you remember some good thing that God did for you, it becomes part of your present, and God is there again. So we taught this to a group of young people in Guayaquil, Ecuador, very poor city. And what they discovered was that when they were in Jesus' presence, they felt peaceful, even though there were problems around. And he showed them a new way of being. So they began to then spontaneously, when they would see the neighbors fighting and, you know, and they're about to get it, you know, break up and the families, they go, hey, you need to come with us and sit with Jesus because we have no idea what to do about your situation. It sounds terrible. But if you sit with Jesus, you'll see and find something that, you know, is going to change who you are. We're just a people who gather and see what Jesus wants us to know. And we'll teach you to do that.
Yes.
And I've had a chance to do that with Hindus and Buddhists and atheists and all kinds of people. And well, guess what? God seems to want to talk to them. He's present. And, you know, I've watched their eyes pop open and say, something just spoke to me. Something just came into my mind. God, I remember one person said, my God consciousness has never been very high, because they were full-out atheists, really. They were willing to take that moment and see if there was something God would say to them. And if people who do that begin to share with others the active presence of God, and it's our faith, not that we know how to solve things, which is the American way. You know, come on down. We know how to work this out. You know, got a good solution for it. We can explain what God thinks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how about we just invite him in?
Yes.
But you only do that when you really feel connected with him. Otherwise, the problems of the world freak you out.
Oh,
yeah.
You're like, what if he doesn't show?
Yeah.
What if he doesn't show? Yes.
Huh.
So I hear you saying, Jim, then that if I'm a leader and I am looking for some practical ways into this, the first thing to do is just to cultivate this attachment. Know that it's available to us. How do I cultivate? How do I create space? And what are the practices that I need to strengthen my attachment to God? Which is growing in. I mean, this is me participating in my own salvation, right? This is me growing in my faith. There's all kinds of biblical ways to talk about this. This is how we actually participate in the life that God is sharing with us, as we grow in our attachment to God. And lots of stuff is going to flow from this.
In the later part of the book, I get into what you might say is my disagreement with Dallas. And I'm only sad because he wasn't no longer alive to have this conversation with.
Yeah.
Because I think we wouldn't have had a disagreement, but although we can go back to, you know, where he was. And see, a lot of us don't realize that Dallas was in a process. He was discovering these things as he went along, and he was always looking for something better than what he had found so far.
Yeah.
And I got to watch that process with him. But he had his VIM model. I don't know if you've heard of vision, intention, and means.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. So the vision part, we all agree with. And most churches in America are very good at presenting vision.
Yeah. And vision, for our listeners, if you're not familiar, what Dallas means by vision is vision of life in the kingdom of God. For us to make any progress, right, we have to have a vision that there is a goodness out there for me. It's the kingdom of God is available to me. I have to see some possibility that gets me off my butt and moves me, right?
Right. And I'm an eternal part of that going forward.
Yes.
So the kingdom of God is out there. I'm in it.
Yes.
And it was the combining those two things that, you know, really gave him some passion. So now, you know, in a sense, we all assent to that.
Sure.
Right. Then there was the means, and I've already said that the means used by counselors for healing and the means used by spiritual disciplines differed.
Yeah.
But it seemed like if you begin to combine them and say, what does this person do now? There was a wider set of means that could be available. And usually what happened is that the spiritual discipline side assumed that people had emotional maturity.
Mm-hmm.
You knew how to do relationships, and the people who didn't know how to do relationships, primarily because they'd grown up with terrible ones, were the ones that couldn't make the spiritual disciplines work. Because, you know, they made room for something they did not know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
So someone had to enter into relationship with them and show you, this is how we do relationship. Mm-hmm. Now when they made room, they say, oh, relationship should exist here with God. But if your brain doesn't know relationship, it has no better idea than if I asked you to talk in Swahili and you didn't happen to have been taught that, you know. It's like, how's that work?
Yeah.
So, but in the middle, that was this intention, vision, intention, and means. The intention was acts of the will. Because that's been the traditional Christian and American view, that what we do is we give people more truth, and then they make better choices, and out of that comes transformation. That formula is so deeply ingrained in us that we try to build a spiritual life by giving more truth and helping people make better choices and then practice it. Mm. But the problem with all of that is it runs in the slow track of the brain, the part that doesn't affect character.
I see.
And it really doesn't explain to us, how do we build a better attachment with God? Well, certainly you need to have truth, because you don't want to create a false attachment, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if I gave you lots and lots of statistics about a child, it doesn't make it feel like here's your child.
Right.
The attachment comes somewhere else. And we haven't been thinking about that. Hmm. So you ask the average Christian, how do you build a better attachment with God? And they'll probably come up with a standard formula. You know, pray more often, you go to church, and you read your Bible.
Yeah.
That should do it. But.
Sounds about right, Jim. What's wrong with that?
Great to have you on the podcast. Good. You heard Jim's advice.
Yeah.
There you go.
No, yeah. So what goes wrong for us then? What would you say goes wrong?
How's that insufficient, I guess?
Yeah. What would you say we need to do instead?
Well, the problem with that is that the part of your brain that builds your character does it by imitating somebody. So it doesn't do it by belief. It doesn't actually understand or listen to words.
Hmm.
So when you give it concepts and precepts, that makes your will stronger, or at least directs it. But the will, as far as your brain is concerned, is like the leaves on the tree. It's what's at the farthest end from what gives you a solid sense, and it's the easiest thing to move. So all you got to do is give it six beers, and it's gone.
Yeah.
Take notes, listeners. Yeah.
Your mileage may vary. Some only four beers. Yeah.
That could be it. I went for a big number just in case.
Yeah. Because there's some people out there being like, five beers, that's not, it's fine. I can do five beers.
Yeah.
But good. So it's insufficient because it's not rooted in kind of what actually moves us.
That's it, yeah. It's actually the easiest thing to change. And the only problem is the Enlightenment has said that's where we have to go with truth. Truth leads to, you know, and then you apply power to that because your will isn't enough. But if you power it up with some extra will from God, you know, now you're going to be able to muscle through this, and then you fake it till you make it kind of a thing. Yeah. But when we're actually imitating somebody, that reaction to be like them, and most of us have decided at some point or another, I'm never going to be like my father or mother, I'm never going to react this way. And then presto, something happens and this part of our brain that we're trying to train acts just like them and does the same thing. You know, how do we get Jesus in there so that the person that our brain wants to copy is like, well, it's like Jesus. Well, interestingly enough, after age 12, it's not looking for an individual. It's looking for a people. In fact, your brain at age 12 or 13 changes so that my survival becomes less important than the survival of my people. And I want to be like the people who endure even after I'm gone. We're looking for that model together. And if Jesus is forming this people, we get a very peculiar people. But our brain will just react like they do because that's what my people do. Kill me, but it isn't going to change that. Yeah. And so that loving attachment to our people is, I think, possibly what Jesus is talking about with his disciples when he says in his final prayer, you know, I pray that they will have the relationship that we have with each other, and they'll take this to the world, and that my joy, that the joy I have with being with God and my joy to be with them is going to be what motivates and directs this. So attachment is caused by the people we're just joyful to be together with. And again, the problem is when I first heard this from neurologists, I thought to myself, I've never really seen joy at church. It's not how I characterize a prayer meeting. It's not how I correct. As service, it's not a meeting of the leaders of the church. None of those places where you maximize the content of Christian leadership were for me characterized by great joy. And if that's what Jesus was after, and if that's what changes character, then we got to really change the way we react with each other. And you know, if we do that, we'll build permanent relationships. So instead of the intention being just willful choices,
by individuals.
By individuals. I wanted to change that middle part and say, no, it's attached. What impels us is actually the strongest force in the human brain, and that's the strength of our attachment, love to one another. And if that's what God means by hesed, if that's what he means by agape, if that's what he means by love, that we are attached to each other in a way that nothing can separate, and it grows stronger. I mean, at first, anything can separate it, but as it grows stronger, nothing will prevail. Not heights, nor depths, nor principalities, or power. Nothing can separate us from this hesed, this attachment to God. If that's what we're building with each other, and every place I do see them building that, I see character change. If that's what we're building with each other, we'd be measuring our church growth in a different way, leadership in a different way. And I think that's where I ended up at the end of this book. It isn't just willful choices. It's it's having that love that make you run into a burning building.
Yeah.
That will keep you going, and when your will is going, I think this is a bad idea.
Yeah,
you know? There's so many things God does is a bad idea.
Right. I think this is so helpful, Jim. And as we kind of wrap things up here, I just want to draw attention to something that you're saying that I think, it would be a profound paradigm shift for a lot of pastors to shift into this model. But I think it's so important that the transformation we want to see, I think that the way I'm thinking about it as you're talking here, Jim, is that I think a lot of us as leaders think about our churches as organizations that help equip individuals in their life with God, right? That we like, you know, if you're and this is why it doesn't feel like any big deal to sort of, you know, like, oh, well, let's just broadcast our services online. You know, that's, the reason it doesn't feel like a big deal is because it's just more people that can be touched by this content, this message that we're preaching that will help them connect with God. You know, that's it.
But what you're,
yes, right. But what you're talking about is such a radical shift that the church is not an organization that provides help for people to connect with God. The church is a community. It is a people, an enduring people, an eternal people It is the means, you could almost say the sacramental means by which we encounter God, that it happens through his body. I mean, Jesus did, the Apostle Paul did say this, right? That our connection with God is mediated through this body, is mediated through this community.
I can paraphrase St. John. He says, if you can't do this with the people that you can see,
right,
can't love them, can't attach to them, how are you going to attach to the God you can't see?
Right.
So I think the practical outworking is we've got to do it with the visible if we're going to make it work with the invisible.
Yeah. Yep. And like you said, Jim, at the beginning, that's deeply challenging because none of us were trained for this. A lot of us were trained against it, actually, saying that's a bad idea to get attached to people. It's just hugely, I don't even know, what to tell people to do next because it's just hugely challenging for people, I think. So
I think the thing that we do next is we really start conversations in which we say, let's look and see, is God an active presence right now? How do we increase that? How do we look at, does he mean for us to be an eternal people? What would we change if we wanted to invite that into our lives? Mm-hmm. And, the interesting thing is once your brain starts saying, oh, there's a solution to learning to love our enemies, it starts looking for opportunities. It's a learning machine.
Yeah.
And controlled by the Spirit, you actually start seeing the workable ones when you do it together.
Yes.
It's really, I think, very impossible for a brain over the age 12 to do this by itself.
So we need each other. We need community. And perhaps the first step is just to begin to raise the vision that this is possible, that transformation is possible if we do it together.
Yeah.
If we can become attached to each other, what do we need to change? How do we need to grow? You convene a conversation and see where it takes you.
I, for curiosity's sake, at the end of the book, I put in an appendix of what would happen if for 12 months of the year, we practiced one of these attachment things, one of these things that builds attachment as a church community.
Oh, that's brilliant.
To me, these are just sort of seeds of ideas, but if we were working on that as a community, I bet there'd be a lot going on.
Yeah, well, that's great. I'm going to encourage people to pick that up. We'll put a link to this book in the show notes. I actually don't know. When does it come out, Jim?
Oh, it's out now.
It's out now. Okay, great.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
I don't know why you haven't gotten a copy.
The
system should have done that to help you, Ben and Matt, have be able to look at this content because it's there.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Well, maybe it's on its way. Yeah, thank you. And hopefully it's on its way, and I do look forward to that. I think that those kinds of practical ideas, like you're talking about at the end of the book, I think it would be so helpful for leaders to know, oh, here's a practice we can engage in. Here's something that will build our attachment with each other, which now we can realize is not just, oh, that'll help us feel better about being in community with each other. No, this actually creates the environment in which we can grow into the kind of people who can love our enemies.
Yes.
I think it's timely too, just because of the COVID situation. We're rethinking how do we group, how do we connect with each other, what is important. I think it's a timely conversation for this time in our history, and it might end us up in a better place when we're done. So,
amen.
Yep. Well, amen.
Thank you so much for having me on, Ben and Matt. It's been great talking with you. Obviously, the start of what I hope is a long conversation for all of us and the people that listen to your podcast.
Yes. Yeah. We really appreciate you spending some time with us, Jim. Your work is really helpful. It's really important. Thanks for doing it. Keep going. We need it.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebbe, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online, as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. you'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.